When you pick up like a piece of classic fantasy media, there's this unwritten contract about what an epic adventure is supposed to look like.
Right, yeah.
You expect adrenaline. You expect this highly trained squad of heroes kicking down ancient doors, hurling world-shattering magic, and
Yeah.
just standing triumphant over defeated evil.
Exactly.
It's always a glorious, fast-paced thrill ride.
But that completely ignores the logistics of reality. I mean, the literature rarely shows you the downtime.
Okay, let's unpack this because our mission in this deep dive is to explore the truly fascinating, hilariously mundane, and just absolutely chaotic reality of what an adventuring session actually looks like when things don't go to script.
Oh, and they rarely do.
Right. We have two source documents guiding us today for you all: a collection of key quotes from an adventuring party, and a deeply detailed journal narrative titled The Table of Edged Wood.
Yeah, that journal is something else.
And I have to be honest, reading through this completely shattered my illusion of the glamorous quest. Because we aren't starting with a dragon fight here, we're starting with a noise complaint.
A noise complaint that lasts for an entire month, no less.
Yeah.
The journal just drops us right into the thick of this psychological pressure cooker. The party is holed up in a giant's forgotten pantry, deep inside a dungeon chamber.
Packed in like sardines.
Exactly. And we see all of this through the perspective of a magic user named Raceland, who is just documenting his own agonizing wait.
Right.
He specifically notes this feeling of minutes crawling into hours and hours clawing into days and days dragging unwillingly into weeks.
I'm just trying to visualize the sheer claustrophobia of that. Like, if you take a group of highly volatile, heavily armed individuals and force them into close proximity for 30 days,
It's a recipe for disaster.
you aren't getting a romantic fellowship. You're getting the worst reality TV house imaginable. It's like a disastrous freshman dorm experience, but with lethal weapons.
That's a perfect way to put it.
You are suddenly forced to confront everyone's disgusting subconscious habits.
And the acoustics of a stone dungeon certainly don't help either.
Yeah.
I mean, Raceland is trying to sleep as far away from the dwarves as possible,
Sure.
but his elvish hearing is just picking up every single mumble. Then the dwarves initiate what he calls a dwarven pack chorus of snoring.
Oh, God.
It is so resonant and deep that it physically shakes the stone beneath their bedrolls.
I read that and immediately wondered how anyone retains their sanity. And the Dwarven Chorus isn't even the worst offender.
No, not at all.
He also has to sleep next to actual wildlife. Carowyn and Albie, who are literal bears, decide to just den right beside his bedroll.
Right, and the journal really details the auditory nightmare that ensues there. Because when the bears aren't having passionate, noisy love, they're arguing.
Yeah.
And when they finally fall asleep, Carowyn produces this heavy, sighing bear snore. Meanwhile, Albie is emitting a sound that just completely defies zoology.
Yeah, it's described as like somewhere between a strangled hoot and a choked roar.
Exactly. And for some reason, there's this inexplicable late-night cooing and chuckling coming from them, too.
It's so weird.
Raceland is only surviving this whole ordeal because he has enchanted earplugs and he basically forces himself to take a daily nap.
Well, I would argue earplugs are totally useless when you consider the ventilation in a subterranean pantry. Like, how do you block out the smells?
Oh, the smells.
Because the biological reality of this group is staggering. Owlbee spends her time hovering over a bucket in the corner, just regurgitating this massive pellet of bone and fur and deeply smellable organic matter, like an oversized owl.
Ugh. And at the exact same time, the dwarves are playing a drinking game they call Fart Smell'em.
I can't even.
They're actively competing to concoct the absolute stinkiest bodily emissions, getting louder and far more fragrant the more ale they consume.
Just delightful.
What's fascinating here is how these intensely gross, mundane details actually serve a vital narrative purpose. They completely demystify the fantasy genre for you. It reminds us that these aren't just marble statues of heroes. They're biological entities with bodily functions forced into tight quarters.
Which totally extends to their personal grooming habits or lack thereof. Look at Gaba. The source mentions he has a severe case of athlete's foot,
Yeah.
and he spends hours just rubbing the bottoms of his feet on a crusty blanket, moaning in relief.
It's so vivid.
And then there's Dirtbag. I need to understand the logic of Dirtbag insisting on doing a morning jazzercise routine in a hostile dungeon.
It makes no
A
sense.
routine that specifically requires him to turn on every single light source in the room. in a dungeon full of monsters drawn to light, he's prioritizing cardio over stealth.
It is entirely irrational.
Yeah.
It's just like Garon wrestling himself to sleep every night with a pair of elven panties literally stuffed in his mouth.
Wait, yeah, that detail alone raises so many questions I don't even want answered. But I want to look at Raistlin's reaction to all of this. He's sitting in the corner, reading by the flickering light of a magical dancing light orb. And the book he's squinting at is about spell performance anxiety.
I love that detail.
I love that concept, too. Magic isn't just waving a wand. It requires precise verbal chanting and somatic gestures. If you stutter, a fireball might just detonate in your face.
Exactly.
So he's stressed, sleep-deprived, surrounded by filth, and terrified of messing up his spells.
Yet the narrative takes a really surprising turn here.
Mm.
As Raistlin drifts off to sleep in that environment, he experiences this dreamborn connection to the group.
Oh, right.
The familiar, gross sounds and smells actually weave into this supportive presence for him. Despite the absolute misery, he realizes he isn't alone. It's a strange but very genuine form of camaraderie.
Yeah, that psychological toll, that combination of exhaustion, forced bonding, and sheer cabin fever, seems to directly explain their disastrous execution when the adventure finally starts.
Definitely.
The calendar hits the 28th day of planting, a free day. They make a solemn vow to leave at first light.
Spoiler alert, they do not leave at first light.
No, they don't.
They don't actually get moving until 11:00, which is essentially late morning.
Right.
And the delays are entirely mundane. First, they have to locate all their scattered parts and pieces. Then, they get bogged down arguing over a marching order simply because the dwarves are too short to see around the people standing in front of them.
I can just picture the logistical nightmare of trying to organize a tactical formation based solely on height.
It's ridiculous.
And just when they finally get the line sorted, Carowyn halts the entire world-saving operation because she needs to run back and pack more pads for a heavy period.
Yeah.
I have to question the traditional concept of heroic destiny here for you. Like, if the fate of the realm hinges on a group that is derailed by menstrual cycles and packing issues, are we really looking at legendary heroes or just a group of incredibly lucky wanderers?
It's a brilliant illustration of the tension between high-stakes goals and low-stakes methods. This friction really defines their entire dynamic. Because once they finally get moving, they reach the Temple of Elemental Evil. The party enters this massive hall with four shimmering doors.
Okay.
The journal establishes that behind any one of these doors could be Eklavdra herself. She's this terrifying antagonist who is clutching a glowing skull, smiling evilly, and ready to unleash destruction.
So we have an apocalyptic threat behind one of four doors. How do highly trained tacticians make this monumental choice? They don't have a map. They don't have a scout.
Nope.
So they fall back on the most sophisticated decision-making algorithm available to them. A best 2 out of 3 game of rock, paper, scissors.
That's so good.
That is literally how they choose the second door.
It completely bypasses any tactical analysis whatsoever. And when they open that randomly chosen door, they step into the Earth Elemental Chamber.
Right.
The source describes it really vividly. The chamber is made of tan stone, opening into an area filled with unnaturally rich soil. And this soil has been packed reverentially into this massive 8-by-15-foot mound. There are intricately carved posts, a rope barrier, smaller offering mounds, and giant shedded worm castings scattered all around.
The environmental storytelling is screaming that they have entered a sacred, highly dangerous elemental nexus.
Screaming.
And Garon, taking in this profound atmosphere, simply states, obviously we are in the Earth Elemental Chamber. That is the full extent of his tactical analysis.
Incredible insight. And while Alistair and Harvey are actually trying to stay focused, reminding the group that they need the elemental crystal of each element to keep Lavra at bay,
yeah.
Raistlin has completely mentally checked out. He isn't listening to the crystal strategy at all. He's just muttering to no one in particular about the, quote, weight of his sack.
Oh, man. Well, here's where it gets really interesting, because the bizarre way they navigate downtime perfectly predicts how they handle life or death combat.
It really does.
If you take an improv comedy troupe and drop them into a tactical military simulation, they aren't going to look for cover. They're going to prioritize the funniest or most creative choice over the safest one. That is exactly how this party approaches a fight.
We see that so clearly in their first encounter. A Zorn rips itself out of the stony surroundings.
A Zorn?
Yeah, a Zorn is essentially an earth elemental. It's a bizarre, rocky beast that survives by consuming precious ores and metals. The journal describes it as a subterranean, rocky Balboa.
Huh.
It speaks in a guttural, marbled common, just demanding yummy meat, talal.
Now, most adventuring parties would draw their swords, establish a defensive perimeter.
Sure.
This party treats a terrifying subterranean predator like a stray dog at a public park.
They do.
They literally just start tossing their unwanted metal scraps at it. And while they're feeding it, Raceland decides this is the perfect time to hide under his cloak in a corner and meditate so he can learn the Move Earth spell.
He's just studying in the middle of a war zone.
Right.
This leaves Harvey to attempt his very first assassination. As a rogue, this is supposed to be his defining moment, right?
Right, his big moment.
He draws his daggers and charges the beast, anticipating a clean kill. But you have to understand the anatomy of the Exhorn. It's made of solid rock.
Yeah.
It doesn't have vital organs in a traditional sense. The Exhorn just watches him approach, mutters something that sounds bizarrely like Hinkley.
Hinkley.
Yeah. And then casually pins Harvey with three of its rock trunk arms.
I am frankly amazed Harvey didn't shatter his wrists on impact.
Seriously.
So Albie tries to help, right?
Yeah.
She crashes in with her tawny arms and crooked beak and actually manages to dislocate one of the Exhorn's arms.
But the creature doesn't even register the pain. Its cave-white eyes just lock onto Harvey's weapon, which is an enchanted Vorpal blade.
Okay, now, mechanically, for anyone who doesn't know, a Vorpal blade is a legendary weapon designed to magically sever heads. It is incredibly lethal.
Very.
So how does the Exhorn neutralize this threat? It swallows the sword whole. Like a circus sword swallower.
Exactly. By eating the weapon, the monster entirely negates the magical lethality of the item. And then it just sinks back into the dungeon floor, emitting this contented mmm with a voice the journal notes sounds strangely like someone named Herb.
Herb.
Yeah. This raises an important question for you listening to this deep dive. What is the actual difference between solving a tactical problem and performing for an audience?
That's a great point.
Because unconventional solutions, like feeding a monster your legendary weapon to make it go away, they completely bypass traditional combat mechanics.
Well, if we're talking about bypassing game mechanics for the sake of a performance, we have to look at the clay golems.
Oh, yes.
Six fleet-footed clay golems charge the party. These are relentless, heavy-hitting constructs. The party cannot outrun them. So Raceland decides to solve the problem using a Joy of Painting correspondence course.
It is just a stunning misuse of a powerful magical item.
It really is.
He puts on an apron, pulls a palette from his bag of holding, and prepares Van Dyke brown and cadmium yellow paint. But these aren't normal paints. He's using Nolzer's marvelous pigments. For those unfamiliar, this item allows the user to paint a two-dimensional object that instantly becomes a three-dimensional reality.
It literally alters the physical environment. It's reality-bending magic, and he uses it to execute a Looney Tunes gag.
Basically, yeah.
He literally paints a yawning chasm onto the dungeon floor, and three of the charging golems run straight into it and fall. He hacks the physics of the dungeon.
He does.
Yeah.
But the fallout from this brilliant move is that Alistair gets furious, not because it was dangerous, but because he laments the lost XP, the experience points.
All right.
Because the golems died to a cliff, not a sword. They don't get credit.
So the tactical discussion immediately devolves into metagaming. They start debating whether they should summon a Tensor's floating disc, which is essentially a magical hoverboard used for carrying heavy loot.
Yeah.
And they want to surf it over the painted chasm to lure the remaining three golems. And their stated goal for this maneuver isn't survival. It's to earn awesomeness points.
Priorities, right.
I find it hilarious that Raceland then decides to deal with the remaining golems purely out of boredom. He uses the polymorph spell.
Okay, yes.
Now, polymorph changes your physical shape, but if you don't fully commit to the bit, your core essence remains.
Right.
Raceland transforms into a, quote, super hot female clay golem, thrusts out an ample hip, hitches up a nightgown, and attempts to seduce the mindless constructs.
Naturally.
He says, "Won't you come over and see me sometime, big boys? I got plenty lovin'." But because he didn't alter his vocal cords properly, his husky bedroom voice sounds like a hungover Justin Bieber calling DoorDash.
The sheer absurdity of the performance is entirely lost on the golems. They're mindless constructs of clay. They have no concept of seduction.
Yeah.
They just stand there inspecting their fingernails. But this instinct to completely ignore the intended rules of engagement doesn't stop at combat.
No, it doesn't.
Once the party realizes they can hack the physics and logic of the monsters, they apply that exact same disrespect to the dungeon's static puzzles and traps.
I love how they treat ancient riddles with the same flippancy as the monsters. They walk away from the unbothered golems and enter a dirt room featuring a large stone slab covered in strange runes.
What?
In a traditional fantasy narrative, this is the moment the wise Stalar steps forward to decipher an ancient, uncrackable language to unlock a secret path. What does this party do? Carowyn tries to translate it using Cub Scout Morse code.
Which is completely anachronistic.
Completely.
The dwarves, not wanting to be outdone, step up and confidently claim the runes are a language called Hammer Talk.
Hammer Talk.
But when pressed to actually read the inscription, they engage in a lot of theatrical beard scratching and knuckle popping.
Stalling.
Yeah. Finally, they offer the excuse that they could easily read it if the runes were written in capital letters, but because it's written in lowercase letters, it's impossible to translate.
I refuse to believe lowercase letters is a real linguistic barrier for dwarves. That is a blatant lie to save face.
Oh, absolutely.
It completely shatters the trope of the historically wise ancient dwarf. It's like a middle schooler standing in front of the class claiming they couldn't finish their homework because their computer only prints in italics.
Exactly.
They have no idea what it says.
This specific interaction highlights a recurring theme of perception versus reality here. The environment is constantly tricking them, but they're also constantly tricking themselves.
Yes.
Consider the trap on the door. They find a door with a lever. Expecting a complex mechanism, they carefully decide to leave the lever in the upper position and perform a hasty, defensive door-opening protocol.
Standard operating procedure.
Right. Garon yanks the door, and a giant spear from a catapult trap narrowly misses his head.
I was looking at the mechanics of this trap, and the UX design of this dungeon is brilliant. They eventually realize the lever doesn't disarm anything at all.
No.
It just toggles whether the door is a push or a pull door. The trap triggered because they overthought a basic mechanical hinge. It is so simple, yet it almost killed them because they were expecting a complex puzzle.
That theme of deceptive simplicity continues when they enter a room full of holes dug into the floor.
Okay.
Garwan spots an iron chest sitting half buried in one of the holes. He uses a staff of opening on it. Now, a staff of opening isn't just a lockpick. It's a magical master override code that forces any lock to yield.
Super powerful.
He pops it open, looks inside, and the chest appears entirely empty.
Which is incredibly frustrating until Raceland looks over his shoulder wearing a gem of seeing.
Right.
The gem of seeing acts like an ultraviolet light at a crime scene. It reveals things hidden by magic or invisibility. Yeah. Looking through the gem, Raceland spots 1,000 invisible gold pieces sitting right there in the empty chest.
See.
Again, the dungeon's primary weapon isn't monsters, it's deceptive perception.
Even the ambient atmosphere is part of the trick. They start to feel a heavy, rhythmic thumping deep in the stone walls. One of the dwarves suddenly decides his comprehension of hammer talk has magically returned. He puts his ear to the ground and dramatically translates, "The earth speaks."
And Raceland, who has absolutely zero patience left for the mystical fantasy aesthetic at this point, just rolls his eyes and calls the dwarf Chief Seattle.
It's such a perfect encapsulation of their mental state.
Mm.
The fatigue has completely eroded their willingness to play along with the dungeon's dramatic tone.
So what does this all mean when they actually face a lethal threat while running on fumes?
Oh.
They're suddenly ambushed in a hallway by 3 ropers.
Oh.
A roper is an incredibly dangerous ambush predator that looks like a stalagmite but attacks with long, grasping tentacles. The ropers clamber down the hallway, snatching the party members and dragging them toward their gaping maws.
It is a desperate fight for survival. They are hacking wild with swords and hurling magic missiles.
Yeah.
But if you look at the key quotes document, the gravity of a life or death struggle is entirely absent. Harvey and Garon are actively making jokes while being dragged toward a monster's mouth. They quip, "Mr. Roper has us in his grasp."
They are literally fighting off an ancient subterranean horror, and they are making references to the landlord from the 1970s sitcom Three's Company.
It's wild.
The other quotes from this combat encounter are just as unhinged. Someone yells, "If you don't pray, you miss your friend's ass," and another shouts, "I fuck in your general direction."
Just total chaos.
They even break the fourth wall completely, renaming the dungeon master. The literal architect and god of their universe, Sergeant Funsucker.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, The omnipresent Sergeant Funsucker is intentionally orchestrating this exhaustion.
Oh, for sure.
The dungeon is a meat grinder designed to drain their resources, both magical and mental. We see the immediate results of that cognitive drain in the aftermath of the Roper fight. They stumble upon skeletons clutching a battle axe buried under a pile of broken wood. Instead of investigating for lore or hidden threats, they just casually guess it was a bar fight and walk away.
Their analytical skills have hit rock bottom.
Bottomed out completely.
They wander into a kitchen and crockery area, and Harvey makes the most amateur tactical blunder imaginable. Looking for hidden treasure, he sticks his entire head straight up a dark, charred chimney.
Oh no.
In a dungeon known to be filled with deadly creatures, putting your head in an enclosed, unlit space is a death wish.
Yeah.
Naturally, he gets bitten in the face by a poisonous snake.
It is a mistake born entirely of fatigue. Luckily, Alistair has enough cognitive function left to manage the medical crisis.
Rarely.
The mechanics of magical healing are specific here. Alistair first casts a spell to slow the poison, buying Harvey crucial time so he doesn't die instantly.
Big move.
Once the immediate threat of death is paused, he casts a second spell to neutralize the poison entirely. But that medical emergency is the final straw.
It has to be. They look around, realize they are battered, poisoned, and mentally checked out, and decide it is time to execute a retreat.
Sensible.
They plan to just kit back to their safe camp in the tower. But in a final display of exhaustion-induced incompetence, they realize they forgot the golden beholder rod.
Oh, no.
I am assuming the rod acts as some sort of magical transportation key.
Correct. Without the rod, their primary means of fast travel is offline.
Wow.
But Tenebris absolutely refuses to spend another night sleeping in a foul-smelling pantry.
I don't blame him.
Out of sheer, stubborn desperation, he figures out a way to utilize scrying. Scrying is a magical method of remote viewing, allowing you to see a distant location or person. He manages to scry to an ally named Kaida, who is back at the camp. Kaida then uses her own magic to mirror the exhausted, bloody party out of the dungeon and back to safety.
I am looking at that retreat, and I don't see a failure. Given everything they endured, escaping alive without the transportation key is a highly realistic acknowledgement of their limits. Which really brings this whole deep dive full circle. We started in that claustrophobic giant's pantry, dealing with horrific smells and spell performance anxiety. And when the adventure finally kicked off, it wasn't the heroic arc the genre promised.
Not at all. It was delayed by 11-season period pads.
Yeah.
The most critical narrative path was chosen by a game of rock, paper, scissors. The combat involved feeding legendary weapons to monsters, painting chasms with reality-bending pigments, and an incredibly flawed Justin Bieber impression.
Amazing.
And the climax wasn't a glorious victory. It was getting bit by a snake in a chimney and begging for a magical ride home.
It is a powerful reminder for you listening to this deep dive right now. Whether you are trying to coordinate a massive project at work, navigating a wildly chaotic team dynamic, or simply trying to survive the week, the messy human elements are universally relatable.
Absolutely.
Arguing over who stands where, desperately needing a nap, or using inappropriate sitcom humor to deflect severe stress, these aren't deviations from the journey. They are the journey.
We often crave the clean, sanitized narrative where every action has a predictable, triumphant outcome. But the reality of human interaction, even in a fantasy setting, is muddy, unpredictable, and deeply flawed.
Which leaves us with a final thought to mull over. If the absolute most memorable parts of an epic fantasy quest are the terrible smells, the ridiculous sitcom jokes during a life or death struggle, and the utterly bizarre tactical choices, does that mean our real world desire to perfectly sanitize and script our own lives is actually depriving us of the best stories? Something to think about the next time you find yourself stuck waiting in a crowded room with someone playing Fart Smell 'Em. Keep diving deep, and we'll catch you next time.